that's where I would disagree with him. I think we're talking here about energy descent rather than an inevitable collapse.
So you don't agree? I mean, he basically says the addict will keep on using until life becomes completely unmanageable. Is that the point of disagreement?
Yeah, I mean, he may well be right. But I don't think that that's necessarily a given. And certainly the hope of the transition movement is that actually, one of the tools that is used, that we use in some aspects of transition, is something from addiction studies, which is called motivational interviewing, which is a very interesting way of working with people in addiction. One of the insights from that is that, the assumption is that people who are in addiction only stop when things become utterly catastrophic. But actually, in motivation interviewing, they say that change comes about when people's core values and what they're doing reach such a degree of discrepancy with each other that they just can't do it anymore. And so my sense is that what transition is trying to do is to try and create that sense of discrepancy. You know, that people want their children to be happier than them, to have better life than they are. But if we continue like we are, that's not going to be the case. So maybe a change in direction, which actually speaks to those values, we can turn this around before that collapse becomes a reality.
One of the things that I thought about as you talked about getting people together to talk about these issues, much of some of the fundamental premises of energy descent are non-starters in the consensus corporate culture. How have you address that, or how have you seen people react to that or respond to that? And have you actually seen that to be the case? Or there are a lot of changes going on now. Perhaps people are more receptive to an alternative vision of the future.
My sense is, from the work that I've done talking to people in organizations and in local government and in national government sometimes, is that people in those positions find themselves really, really stuck because they have the model that they have promoted for so long of economic growth and globalization and so on is really, really coming unstuck. But it's very, very difficult still for people in those positions to articulate for or push for anything else. The economic situation over the last year has been very helpful with that. But I often find a lot of the time, if you go into organizations, that people there are really glad for the space to be able to talk about these things and to be able to look at the possibilities and the opportunities that emerge out of this. And so transition groups, I think, are doing really, really important work in asking questions that those organizations often can't do. So Stroud, for example, is one of the longer established transition initiatives here in the UK. They've been doing a lot of work with their local council. In effect, they wrote their local council's food policy, and the deputy head of the council there said, if Transition Stroud didn't exist, we'd have had to make them up. And I think that's what we're starting to see now, is actually not... You know, sometimes people say, but don't you get loads of resistance? You know, doesn't sort of somehow the establishment try and dampen transition down or something? Actually, it's very much the other way around. I think we're seen as asking questions that really need to be asked and coming up with answers that they struggle to do themselves. Lots and lots since we've been doing transition is that there's lots of questions or observations where people say, oh, well, that's all very well, but I'll get them on this one, you know. And there's a kind of a list that people put up, which is of things that, well, you can't even think about doing transition until you have whatever, you know. So until you have got rid of the idea of economic growth, there's no point even beginning. Until you've got rid of international corporate capitalism, there's no point even thinking about transition. You know, and actually, I think if we set ourselves a list like that, then we're never going to get anything done. And actually, I always return to what I heard Vandana Shiva say about 15 years ago, when she said, these systems function because we give them our support. And if we withdraw our support, then they're no longer able to function. And so for me, transition is a way of communities withdrawing their support, but in a way which is a positive step forward. And we could waste a huge amount of energy thinking, but they won't let us, but the powers, the structures are too hard and too tight. Well, actually, I think economically that system is already unraveling at a rate of knots. I don't think that the bailouts are going to do that much in the long term. The reality is that we're entering very difficult economic territory. And again, it's about resilience. It comes back to this idea about building resilience. And yes, there are some aspects of building resilience where you need to work with the government, and there are a lot of elements of resilience that you can just get on with. But if we present these things as being about resistance and campaign, and we set up a very adversarial them and us kind of a dynamic, then the quality of what we do, I think, is very different from when we say, well, we're all in this together. What are we going to do about this? What's the most skillful way to proceed from this point forward? And there are lots of people involved in transition, and certainly not everybody, but people who are involved actively in campaigning in different ways. But transition initiatives themselves take a perspective of not campaigning against things. Their starting point isn't whose fault is this, and isn't about who do we need to campaign against here. Its starting point is that we're all in this together. But as I said, transition isn't the only thing that's going to get us through, but I think it's going to be one of the important elements of that.
Well, I agree with you on most of what you just said. What you describe is what I like to call a silent revolution, in that it focuses on those positive steps forward and doesn't seem like much of a revolution at all. But when you take it all together and you actually look at what people are doing, it's extremely revolutionary, like the statement, permaculture is revolution disguised as gardening. Yeah. I think that's very apt, and I think it's very appropriate to what you were saying. However, there's one caveat that I'd like to add, and that is that these power structures that Ralph Nader refers to, like you said, they rely on our attention and our tacit support. So what we are talking about in the form of transition towns and permaculture is, I would say, fairly clearly against their interests, against the interests of the corporate model, whether we're adversarial about it or not. Now, that said, I think that it's probably important for people at least to be aware of that, so that when there are when it comes to the point that this transition movement becomes powerful, and when it comes to the point that it becomes very effective, there will be propaganda and attempts perhaps to derail it. But that is to perhaps be expected, and that just means that we're being successful.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that will be the case. But actually, when we started doing this, if I'd have believed what we were told when we started doing this, by now we'd have had loads and loads and loads of that. Everyone was like, well, if this gets anywhere, you'll have this and you'll have that and you'll have the other. I think what we've tried to do with transition is to design something which comes in under the radar, and it hasn't set out a confrontational element to it. So, there's a kind of a dance, I think, that goes on, which is that in some ways transition is like a Trojan horse. It's like it has permaculture inside it and it has various things, but really the way that's not worn on its sleeve. There's lots about transition that's implicit but not made explicit, which means that we can go and talk to and work with some big organizations, and we're addressing where they're at and where they're coming from. There's something about transition as an idea which is quite viral and easy to communicate and quite sticky, which means that it pops up in the most unexpected places. And I'm very mindful of there have been lots of previous movements who found themselves undermined or subverted or got, pushed to one side or whatever. But I think very often there's an explicitly adversarial element to those, which doesn't exist with transition. And I think the fact that we're asking questions, not coming up with all the answers, but just asking questions which other organizations really haven't been thinking about and need to be asking, and starting those discussions means that actually I think increasingly we're seen as performing quite a valuable service in that regard as well.
Rob, one of the fundamental differences I think that we're experiencing now, I mean, you go back to the 19th century, and I think that I really feel that people had no alternative than to be adversarial because of the nature of production, because of the nature of technology, because of the capital-intensive requirements. And now we live in a time where we are on the verge of being liberated and perhaps don't even realize it. We have things like riprap that allow for distributed fabrication, in small workshops. We have things like, you know, tabletop table saws that seem like a, you know, very simple technology to us now, but 200 years ago, that type of technology was unheard of. And to have that fabrication technology at our disposal, it's really revolutionary in a way that people don't realize. And the amount of processing and computing power that people have on their desktop computers now is unprecedented. So all of these things are kind of converging at the same time that, are making our demise seem inevitable on the one hand, but are also the key to our liberation and our avoidance of that demise.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we have astonishing things and tools at our disposal. Absolutely. And I suppose one of the things that I found really fascinating is, you know, that when we started, people were like, oh, well, you know, you're going to get attacked by the establishment and this, that, and the other. Actually, the main place where the critiques and the sort of attacks on what transition is trying to do actually is coming from the very sort of the more radical sort of green community who sort of see it as not being, because it doesn't start out with this sort of belief that you have to get rid of capitalism first and all these kind of things. I mean, actually, I think if you wait, I don't know quite, there seems to be a thing sometimes where people can't quite believe that it's actually possible to achieve these things, and we come up with ways of sort of talking ourselves out of achieving the potential that we could actually create here. And I think that thing is sort of, well, they'll shut us down, they'll stop us. I don't think that's the case. I think actually what we're seeing in transition and in what Paul Hawken talks about, you know, the millions of environmental projects around the world, you know, he talks about it as being like the Earth's immune system kicking in at this time in history. I think that's going to be kind of unstoppable, because it has to be, really.
Right, and some people will say, well, it's naive to think that at some point confrontation is not inevitable. And actually, there's an interview that I have just recently done with Doug Lane, who is also a podcaster that will be published in the future on the AgriInnovations podcast. But that was his response. And, you know, after I thought about it, well, my response to that is, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. But in the meantime, let's build these parallel systems and let's make them strong. And once we have strong parallel systems, we'll be in a much better position to deal with that when it does come.
Yeah, because actually, if the work that you're doing is putting in place the parallel systems, and they work, and they are inclusive, and they are socially just, and they're financially viable, and you've done them properly, and then the models that you're putting to replace, which are inherently unsustainable and profoundly oil vulnerable, inevitably begin to demise, then why is anybody going to want to get rid of those systems? I mean, they're the systems that people are going to be depending on. I think if we present those systems in a confrontational, our system's better than your system, kind of adversarial, kind of nah, 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 sort of way, you know, then you do generate a kind of a degree of resentment and stuff, which can, you know, which can over time lead to that kind of response. But actually, I think if we, you know, if a community sets up its own energy company, and it offers a share option, and half of the people in the community own shares in the renewable energy that's being put in around where they live, and they can see the benefits of that renewable energy, and that the money that's being generated by that company is going into supporting other projects, and then the national energy infrastructure is struggling more and more and more, then, you know, then you have something that everybody appreciates, I would think. Maybe I'm just tremendously naive, but that's really what I base my work on, you know, is that actually we just get on with it and just start building them, you know.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. It's probably at the very least important to be aware of the context and the significance of what we're doing, and then, as you said, get on with doing it.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I mean, you have to read Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine book, you know, to kind of get some kind of a sense of the wider framework that we're working within, and the challenges and the stresses and the, you know, the motivations of some of the people, you know, in some of the things that are happening. But what do? Either we try and fight against that, you know, sort of in a kind of revolutionary kind of a way, or we just have a very sort of campaign-focused sort of political thing, which is very valuable and it's very important. Some people do that, or we just get on and we just work away and we engage communities where we are and we start building a parallel infrastructure. You know, it's not the only thing that we need, but it's a key part of it.
Well, I'm sure you're also familiar with the work of James Howard Kunstler, who is not at all optimistic about the prospects for permaculture in a suburban environment. And actually, I am trying to organize a podcast around that theme. I don't want to say too much because it has not happened yet. But I just want to know what your thoughts on the prospects of permaculture in a suburban environment are. In response to Kunstler's assertion that it's going to be too costly, the infrastructure as it is now is really shoddily built despite the trillions of dollars of an investment, and people are eventually just going to abandon much of suburbia, and it's just going to be kind of a blight on the landscape, and we're really just going to move into towns and cities and rural landscapes in the future. What are your thoughts on the prospects of permaculture in suburbia?
Well, I think the first thing to say is I've never been to the U.S., so you do suburbia in quite a different way than we do suburbia here. And so my when I talk about suburbia, I'm really kind of thinking about the suburbia around London, you know, which actually a lot of that suburbia was designed with the idea of, you know, their houses with big gardens, but they're quite good sort of in terms of rail connectivity, and in many ways I think they will become the market gardens of the future, the market towns. You know, if you've got houses with garden around them, I think that actually the permaculturing of British suburbia, of London suburbia, has huge potential, but I mean, all I know about suburbia in America is the end of suburbia, which doesn't paint a very good picture of its chances. So I can't really comment. You know, it would be entirely kind of fanciful and notional because I've not actually been there. But my sense in the UK in terms of suburbia is that there's a lot of potential there, although it will require a rethinking about how we inhabit those spaces, how we inhabit the houses, how people get around, and so on. But I think when we look at the cities and their food needs, and we rethink suburbia as being the market gardens that supply suburbia, like kind of patchwork farms, you know, farms made up of skilled gardeners producing some for their own needs and some for sale. You know, I think I think human creativity and permaculture principles can do really quite extraordinary things. But as I say, I wouldn't like to sound like I'm speaking remotely authoritatively about U.S. suburbia because I've never actually been there.
Well, as someone who is personally actively engaged in trying to apply the principles of permaculture in my suburban environment, I can say that in my own mind, the jury is still out as to whether this is going to be a successful endeavor. And one of the reasons I say that is because I'm one of the few that's actively engaged in doing that. And the challenges are significant, although I do feel that the technological obstacles are probably small compared to the behavioral obstacles that we face.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. One of the things that was very interesting, I lived in Ireland for 10 years. Ireland experienced this huge economic boom that was referred to as the Celtic Tiger, where it went from being a relatively a small economy, very rural economy, to being a very booming economy, which all went rather pear-shaped over the last year. Big recession underway in Ireland. One of the things that's been very interesting there is because the economy was really built around the construction industry. So there's now a huge amount of unemployed builders in Ireland, many of whom are retraining as organic growers, particularly in Dublin. And there's lots of organic growers, lots of former builders now who are setting up organic gardening businesses in and around the city. And I think, necessity is the mother of invention, I think we can do extraordinary things. Although I do think one of the things that's come out of work we've been doing at Transition Network and out of the Contotness and District Feed Itself paper that I mentioned earlier on was looking at that kind of urban permaculture, that urban food production in a wider context is really important. Because if we imagine that our suburban settlement is going to be able to produce everything that it eats, we're kidding ourselves. So Totnes, for example, growing its vegetables is easy. It's the cereals, it's the carbohydrates, it's the fats, it's the sugars that are the harder bit, which farming does much, much better than gardening. And so, if we look at suburbia and we say it has to produce, it has to be self-sufficient, it's not going to happen. But if we look at meeting our vegetable needs, our fruit needs, and some of our energy needs from there, and then cereals and so on coming from farmland adjoining, then I think we have a model which has much more potential for being successful.
Well, yes, and by doing that, I mean, in my permacultural forays here in suburbia, I can say that I can grow a tomato much more efficiently than a grower in California can do. And I can build on a micro scale, I can build an extremely robust biological community, in an area that's 4 feet by 8 feet. And that's not something, that's something that can be done very feasibly in a suburban environment. And that frees up the prime farmland in places like California to do exactly what you said, produce carbohydrates.
I mean, you're not going to grow enough wheat to feed your family from a window box.
Obviously.
Or from a small back garden, But actually, if all the different elements are doing what they do best, and if it's based around the proximity principle of things being supplied as close as where to the closest market, then I think we can do it. And I think suburbia has an enormous role to play.
Well, Consular would say that perhaps that's not where we're going to run into the obstacles. It's in actually continuing to service the decaying infrastructure in suburbia that really was built on cheap petroleum. And once you unplug that cheap petroleum, you won't be able to do that anymore. However, in contrast to that view, I think what you were saying earlier in the interview, in the sense that if you actually sit down and maybe take a look at these issues and actually look at how much energy would be required to do this, maybe we can find a reasonable compromise and perhaps dedicate what petroleum resources we have left to managing and maintaining that critical infrastructure, and then, you know, eliminate the things like cruising around in SUVs on Saturday nights.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose ultimately I think that human beings are incredibly adaptable and creative. And, you know, I suppose, you know, sometimes people talk about the idea of localization and a kind of transitioned world as being somehow utopian, which I don't agree with at all. And I suppose for me, really, having taught permaculture for years, it's really, in my head anyway, my vision of the future is really a kind of an assembly of things that I've already seen happening in other places. You know, it's like a combination of so-and-so's garden and so-and-so's house and so-and-so's way of getting around and that really good forest garden that so-and-so made. You know, all the different pieces are there. You know, this stuff is all tried and tested. It's like you said earlier on, it's about the human side of it and the community side of it and how we motivate and people and engage and sustain that momentum. Actually, the nuts and bolts side of it is the easy part of it.
And a corollary from what Rob Hopkins is saying there is, if you don't know permaculture, if you've understood the politics, the economics, you know the world is run by psychopaths and we're hitting trouble with peak oil, then if you have that mindset, it's actually not difficult to look at the mechanics of relocalization. It's a set of techniques. Starts with growing food, and as things get tighter, more and more people are getting involved in this, getting interested in this, never mind what they say on the goggle box in the corner. And inevitably, it does involve some kind of deprogramming. We've got to rethink things we think we know. And for me, the biggest one has been money. So we're going to return now. We're going to finish Chapter 7, finally, from David Graeber's Debt, The First 5,000 Years, looking at what does it mean to be free. I think, in a real sense, as long as we are dependent on money, we will not be free, precisely because it's not our system. Whether we will need alternative accounting systems, whether we can keep things in our heads, whether a gift economy will triumph, there will be abundance, I can't say. But let's return to finish Chapter 7 and start on Chapter 8. This is David Graeber's Debt, The First 5,000 Years. To be free, by definition, meant to be anchored in a civic community, with all the rights and responsibilities that this entailed. By the 2nd century AD, however, this had begun to change. The jurists gradually redefined libertas until it became almost indistinguishable from the power of the master. It was the right to do absolutely anything, with the exception, again, of all those things one could not do. Actually, in the Digest, the definitions of freedom and slavery appear back to back. Quote, "Freedom is the natural faculty to do whatever one wishes that is not prevented by force or law. Slavery is an institution according to the law of nations, whereby one person becomes private property, dominium, of another, contrary to nature." Unquote. Medieval commentators immediately noticed the problem here. But wouldn't this mean that everyone is free? After all, even slaves are free to do absolutely anything they're actually permitted to do. To say a slave is free, except insofar as he isn't, is a bit like saying the earth is square except insofar as it's round, or that the sun is blue except insofar as it is yellow, or again, that we have an absolute right to do anything we wish with our chainsaw, except those things we can't. In fact, the definition introduces all sorts of complications. If freedom is natural, then surely slavery is unnatural. But if freedom and slavery are just matters of degree, then, logically, wouldn't all restrictions on freedom be to some degree unnatural? Wouldn't that imply that society, social rules, in fact even property rights, are unnatural as well? This is precisely what many Roman jurists did conclude. That is, when they did venture to comment on such abstract matters, which was only rarely. Originally, human beings lived in a state of nature where all things were held in common. It was war that first divided up the world, and the resultant law of nations, the common usages of mankind that regulate such matters as conquest, slavery, treaties, and borders, that was first responsible for inequalities of property as well.
This, in turn, meant that there was no intrinsic difference between private property and political power, at least insofar as that power was based in violence. As time went on, Roman emperors also began claiming something like dominion, insisting that within their dominions they had absolute freedom, in fact, that they were not bound by laws. At the same time, Roman society shifted from a republic of slaveholders to arrangements that increasingly resembled later feudal Europe, with magnates on their great estates surrounded by dependent peasants, debt servants, and an endless variety of slaves, with whom they could do largely as they pleased. The barbarian invasions that overthrew the empire merely formalized the situation, largely eliminating chattel slavery, but at the same time introducing the notion that the noble classes were really descendants of the Germanic conquerors, and that the common people were inherently subservient. Still, even in this new medieval world, the old Roman concept of freedom remained. Freedom was simply power. When medieval political theorists spoke of liberty, they were normally referring to a lord's right to do whatever he wanted within his own domains. This was, again, usually assumed not to be something originally established by agreement, but a mere fact of conquest. One famous English legend holds that when, around 1270, King Edward I asked his lords to produce documents to demonstrate by what right they held their franchises, or liberties, the Earl Warrenne presented the king only with his rusty sword. Like Roman dominium, it was less a right than a power, and a power exercised first and foremost over people, which is why in the Middle Ages it was common to speak of the liberty of the gallows, meaning a lord's right to maintain his own private place of execution. By the time Roman law began to be recovered and modernized in the 12th century, the term dominium posed a particular problem, since it had come, in ordinary church Latin of the time, to be used equally for lordship and private property. Medieval jurists spent a great deal of time on argument, establishing whether there was indeed a difference between the two. It was a particularly thorny problem because, if property rights really were, as the Digest insisted, a form of absolute power, it was very difficult to see how anyone could have it but a king, or even, for certain jurists, God. This is not the place to describe the resulting arguments, but I feel it's important to end here, because, in a way, it brings us full circle and allows us to understand precisely how liberals like Adam Smith were able to imagine the world the way they did. This is a tradition that assumes that liberty is essentially the right to do what one likes with one's own property. In fact, not only does it make property a right, it treats rights themselves as a form of property. In a way, this is the greatest paradox of all. We are so used to the idea of having rights, that rights are something one can possess, that we rarely think about what this might actually mean. In fact, as medieval jurists were well aware, one man's right is simply another's obligation. My right to free speech is others' obligation not to punish me for speaking. My right to a trial by jury of my peers is the responsibility of the government to maintain the system of jury duty. When we're talking about obligations owed by everyone in the entire world, it's difficult to think about it that way. It's much easier to speak of having rights and freedoms. Still, if freedom is basically our right to own things, or to treat things as if we own them, then what would it mean to own freedom? Wouldn't it have to mean that our right to own property is itself a form of property? That does seem unnecessarily convoluted. What possible reason would one have to want to define it this way? Historically, there is a simple, if somewhat disturbing, answer to this. Those who've argued that we're the natural owners of our rights and liberties have been mainly interested in asserting that we should be free to give them away or even to sell them. Modern ideas of rights and liberties are derived from what? From the time when Jean Gerson, rector of the University of Paris, began to lay them out around 1400, building on Roman law concepts, came to be known as natural rights theory. As Richard Tuck, A premier historian of such ideas has long noted, it's one of the great ironies of history, that this was always a body of theory embraced not only by the progressives of that time, but by the conservatives. For a Gersonian, liberty was property and could be exchanged in the same way, and in the same terms as any other property, sold, swapped, loaned, or otherwise voluntarily surrendered. It followed that there could be nothing intrinsically wrong with, say, debt peonage, or even slavery, and this is exactly what natural rights theorists came to assert. In fact, over the next centuries, these ideas came to be developed above all in Antwerp and Lisbon, cities at the very heart of the emerging slave trade. After all, they argued, we don't really know what's going on in the lands behind places like Calabar, but there's no intrinsic reason to assume that the vast majority of the human cargo conveyed to European ships had not sold themselves, or been disposed of by their legal guardians, or lost their liberty in some other perfectly legitimate fashion. No doubt, some had not, but abuses will exist in any system. The important thing was that there was nothing inherently unnatural or illegitimate about the idea that freedom could be sold. Before long, similar arguments came to be employed to justify the absolute power of the state. Thomas Hobbes was the first to really develop this argument in the 17th century, but it soon became commonplace. Government was essentially a contract, a kind of business arrangement, whereby citizens had voluntarily given up some of their natural liberties to the sovereign. Finally, similar ideas have become the basis of that most basic, dominant institution of our present economic life, wage labour, which is, effectively, the renting of our freedom in the same way that slavery can be conceived as its sale. It's not only our freedoms that we own. The same logic has come to be applied even to our own bodies, which are treated, in such formulations, as really no different than houses, cars, or furniture. We own ourselves, therefore outsiders have no right to trespass on us. Again, this might seem as innocuous, even a positive notion, but it looks rather different when we take into consideration the Roman tradition of property on which it's based. To say that we own ourselves is, oddly enough, to cast ourselves as both master and slave simultaneously. We are both owners, exerting absolute power over our property, and yet somehow, at the same time, the things being owned, being the object of absolute power. The ancient Roman household, far from having been forgotten in the mists of history, is preserved in a most basic conception of ourselves. And once again, just as in property law, the result is so strangely incoherent that it spins off into endless paradoxes the moment one tries to figure out what it would actually mean in practice. Just as lawyers have spent 1,000 years trying to make sense of Roman property concepts, so have philosophers spent centuries trying to understand how it could be possible for us to have a relation of dominance over ourselves. The most popular solution, to say that each of us has something called a mind, and that this is completely separate from something else, which we can call the body, and that the first thing holds natural dominion over the second, flies in the face of just about everything we know about cognitive science. It's obviously untrue, but we continue to hold on to it anyway, for the simple reason that none of our everyday assumptions about property law and freedom would make any sense without it. Conclusions. The first 4 chapters of this book describe a dilemma. We don't really know how to think about debt, or, to be more accurate, we seem to be trapped between imagining society in the Adam Smith mode as a collection of individuals whose only significant relations are with their own possessions, happily bartering one thing for another for the sake of mutual convenience, with debt almost entirely abolished from the picture, and a vision in which debt is everything, the very substance of all human relations, which of course leaves everyone with the uncomfortable sense that human relations are somehow an intrinsically tawdry business, that our very responsibilities to one another are already somehow necessarily based in sin and crime. It's not an appealing set of alternatives. In the last 3 chapters, I've tried to show that there's another way of looking at these things, and then to describe how it is that we got here. This is why I developed the concept of human economies, ones in which what is considered really important about human beings is the fact that they are each a unique nexus of relations with others, therefore that no one could ever be considered exactly equivalent to anyone or anything else. In a human economy, money is not a way of buying or trading human beings, but a way of expressing just how much one cannot do so. I then went on to describe how all this can begin to break down, how humans can become objects of exchange, first perhaps women given in marriage, ultimately slaves captured in war. What all these relations have in common, I observed, was violence. Whether it's TIV girls being tied up and beaten for running away from their husbands, or husbands being herded into slave ships to die on faraway plantations, that same principle always applies. It is only by the threat of sticks, ropes, spears, and guns that one can tear people out of these endlessly complicated webs of relationship with others, sisters, friends, rivals, that render them unique, and thus reduce them to something which can be traded. All of this, it's important to emphasize, can happen in places where markets in ordinary everyday goods, clothing, tools, foodstuffs, do not even exist. In fact, in most human economies, one's most important possessions could never be bought and sold for the same reasons that people can't. They're unique objects, caught up in a web of relationships with human beings. My old professor, John Komaroff, used to tell a story about carrying out a survey in Natal, in South Africa. He just spent most of a week driving from homestead to homestead in a jeep with a box full of questionnaires and a Zulu-speaking interpreter, driving past apparently endless herds of cattle. After about 6 days, his interpreter suddenly started and pointed into the middle of one of the herd. "Look, that's the same cow. That one there, with a red spot on his back. We saw it 3 days ago in a place 10 miles from here. I wonder how that happened. Did someone get married? Or maybe there was a settlement to some dispute." In human economies, when this ability to rip people from their context does appear, it's most often seen as an end in itself. One can already see a hint of this among the Lele. Important men would occasionally acquire war captives from far away as slaves, but it was almost always to be sacrificed at their funeral. The squelching of one man's individuality was seen as somehow swelling the reputation, the social existence, of the other. In what I've been calling heroic societies, this kind of addition and subtraction of honour and disgrace is lifted from a somewhat marginal practice to become the very essence of politics. As endless epics, sagas, and eddas attest, heroes become heroes by making others small. In Ireland and Wales, we observe how this very ability to degrade others, to remove unique human beings from their hearths and families, and thus render them anonymous units of accounting, the Irish slave girl currency, the Welsh washerwomen, is itself the highest expression of honour. In heroic societies, the role of violence is not hidden, it's glorified. Often, it can form the basis of one's intimate relations. In the Iliad, Achilles sees nothing shameful in his relation with his slave girl, Briseis, whose husband and brothers he killed. He refers to her as his prize of honour, but in almost the very same breath. He also insists that just as any decent man must love and care for his household dependents, so I, from my heart, loved this one, even though I won her with my spear. That such relations of intimacy can often develop between men of honour and those they have stripped of their dignity, history can well attest. After all, the annihilation of any possibility of equality also eliminates any question of debt, of any relation other than power. It allows a certain clarity. This is presumably why emperors and kings have such a notorious tendency to surround themselves with slaves or eunuchs. There is something more here, though. If one looks across the expanse of history, one cannot help but notice a curious sense of identification between the most exalted and the most degraded, particularly between emperors and kings, and slaves. Many kings surround themselves with slaves, appoint slave ministers. There have even been, as with the Mamluks in Egypt, actual dynasties of slaves. Kings surround themselves with slaves for the same reason that they surround themselves with eunuchs, because the slaves and criminals have no families and friends, no possibility of other loyalties, or at least that, in principle, they shouldn't. But, in a way, kings should really be like that too, as many an African proverb emphasizes. A proper king has no relatives either, or at least he acts as if he does not. In other words, the king and slave are mirror images, in that unlike normal human beings who are defined by their commitments to others, they are defined only by relations of power. They are as close to perfectly isolated, alienated human beings as one can possibly become. At this point, we can finally see what's at stake in our peculiar habit of defining ourselves simultaneously as master and slave, reduplicating the most brutal aspects of the ancient household in our very concept of ourselves, as masters of our freedoms, or as owners of our very selves. It is the only way that we can imagine ourselves as completely isolated beings. There is a direct line from the new Roman conception of liberty, not as the ability to form mutual relationships with others, but as the kind of absolute power of use and abuse over the conquered chattel, who make up the bulk of a wealthy Roman man's household, to the strange fantasies of liberal philosophers like Hobbes, Locke, and Smith about the origins of human society, in some collection of 30 or 40-year-old males who seem to have sprung up from the earth fully formed, and then have to decide whether to kill each other or to begin to swap beaver pelts. European and American intellectuals, it's true, have spent much of the last 200 years trying to flee from the more disturbing implications of this tradition of thought. Thomas Jefferson, that owner of many slaves, chose to begin the Declaration of Independence by directly contradicting the moral basis of slavery, writing, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights," thus undercutting simultaneously any argument that Africans were racially inferior, and also that they or their ancestors could ever have been justly and legally deprived of their freedom. In doing so, however, he did not propose some radically new conception of rights and liberties, neither have subsequent political philosophers. For the most part, we've just kept the old ones, but with the word "not" inserted here and there. Most of our most precious rights and freedoms are a series of exceptions to an overall moral and legal framework that suggests we shouldn't really have them in the first place. Formal slavery has been eliminated, but, as anyone who works from 9 to 5 can testify, the idea that you can alienate your liberty, at least temporarily, endures. In fact, it determines what most of us have to do for most of our waking hours, except usually on weekends. The violence has been largely pushed out of sight, but this is largely because we're no longer able to imagine what a world based on social arrangements that did not require the continual threat of tasers and surveillance cameras would even look like.
Now, David Graeber penned those words before he was so successful in organizing the Occupy Wall Street movement. I wonder whether he would now suspect that the Occupy movements worldwide may be prefiguring a new set of social arrangements with rights and liberties defined more by a consensus than by a hierarchy, one in which horizontal rather than vertical power arrangements tend to be the rule. I've always found living in a squat quite a liberating experience, and one that forced me to rethink what I thought the world was like in terms of ownership, who gets to call the tune. Consensus processes become much more important when there isn't a clear line of power, and the rights and the laws and the power that people grown up with are in one sense just dependent on some privileged persons and their power to say yea and nay, legal, illegal, and of course the violence of a bunch of enforcers to back them up. If in a post-peak oil world we haven't got the energy for that sort of thing, then consensuses and local agreements become much more important, as of course they still are in many areas of the world, such as Bangladesh, where if you're in the village, then the laws passed in the cities tend to be regarded as fairly optional. Well, actually, that's fairly true in the cities themselves, but it's a different approach to what goes on, much more defined by local communities. And I think that is the shape of things to come, and people in the Occupy movements are trying their best to rediscover this, while centralized hierarchies are trying their best to say no, there's no exceptions to these rules, and trying to make an example of the Occupy movements. And now let's make a start on the next chapter of David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years.
Chapter 8. Credit versus Bullion and the Cycles of History. Begins with a quote from Geoffrey Gardiner. Bullion is the accessory of war and not of peaceful trade. One might well ask, if our political and legal ideas really are founded on the logic of slavery, then how did we ever eliminate slavery? Of course, a cynic might argue that we haven't, we've just relabeled it. The cynic would have a point. An ancient Greek slave would certainly have seen the distinction between a slave and an indebted wage labourer as, at best, a legalistic nicety. Still, even the elimination of formal chattel slavery has to be considered a remarkable achievement, and it is worthwhile to wonder how it was accomplished, especially since it was not just accomplished once. The truly remarkable thing, if one consults the historical record, is that slavery has been eliminated, or effectively eliminated, many times in human history. In Europe, for instance, the institution largely vanished in the centuries following the collapse of the Roman Empire, an historical achievement rarely recognized by those of us used to referring to these events as the beginning of the Dark Ages. No one is quite sure how it happened. Most agree that the spread of Christianity must have had something to do with it, but that can't have been the direct cause, since the church itself was never explicitly opposed to the institution, and in many cases defended it. Instead, the abolition appears to have happened despite the attitudes of both the intellectuals and the political authorities of the time. Yet it did happen, and it had lasting effects. On the popular level, slavery remained so universally detested that even 1,000 years later, when European merchants started trying to revive the trade, they discovered that their compatriots would not countenance slaveholding in their own countries, one reason why planters were eventually obliged to acquire their slaves in Africa and set up plantations in the New World. It is one of the great ironies of history that modern racism, probably the single greatest evil of our last 2 centuries, had to be invented largely because Europeans continued to refuse to listen to the arguments of the intellectuals and jurists and did not accept that anyone they believed to be a full and equal human being could ever be justifiably enslaved. What's more, the demise of ancient slavery was not limited to Europe. Remarkably, right around the same time, in the years around 600 AD, we find almost exactly the same thing happening in India and China, where, over the course of centuries, amidst much unrest and confusion, chattel slavery largely ceased to exist. What all this suggests is that moments of historical opportunity, moments when meaningful change is possible, follow a distinct, even a cyclical pattern, one that has long been far more coordinated across geographical space than we would ever have imagined. There is a shape to the past, and it is only by understanding it that we can begin to have a sense of the historical opportunities that exist in the present. The easiest way to make these cycles visible is to re-examine exactly the phenomenon we've been concerned with over the course of this book, the history of money, debt, and credit. The moment we begin to map the history of money across the last 5,000 years of Eurasian history, startling patterns begin to emerge. In the case of money, one event stands out above all others, the invention of coinage. Coinage appears to have arisen independently in 3 different places almost simultaneously. On the Great Plain of northern China, in the Ganges River Valley of northeastern India, and in the lands surrounding the Aegean Sea. In each case, between roughly 600 and 500 BC. And this wasn't due to some sudden technological innovation. The technologies used in making the first coins were, in each case, entirely different. It was a social transformation. Why this happened in exactly this way is an historical mystery. But this much we know. For some reason, in Lydia, India, and China, local rulers decided that whatever long-standing credit systems had existed in their kingdoms
were no longer adequate, and they began to issue tiny pieces of precious metals, metals that had previously been used largely in international commerce, in ingot form, and to encourage their subjects to use them in day-to-day transactions. From there, the innovation spread. For more than 1,000 years, states everywhere started issuing their own coinage. But then, right around 600 AD, about the time that slavery was disappearing, the whole trend was suddenly thrown into reverse. Cash dried up. Everywhere, there was a movement back to credit once again. If we look at Eurasian history over the course of the last 5,000 years, what we see is a broad alternation between periods dominated by credit money and periods in which gold and silver come to dominate. That is, those during which at least a large share of transactions were conducted with pieces of valuable metal being passed from hand to hand. Why? The single most important factor would appear to be war. Bullion predominates, above all, in periods of generalized violence. There's a very simple reason for that. Gold and silver coins are distinguished from credit arrangements by one spectacular feature. They can be stolen. A debt is, by definition, a record, as well as a relation of trust. Someone accepting gold or silver in exchange for merchandise, on the other hand, need trust nothing more than the accuracy of the scales, the quality of the metal, and the likelihood that someone else will be willing to accept it. In a world where war and the threat of violence are everywhere, and this appears to have been an equally accurate description of the warring states China, Iron Age Greece, and pre-Mauryan India, there are obvious advantages to making one's transactions simple. This is all the more true when dealing with soldiers. On the other hand, soldiers tend to have access to a great deal of loot, much of which consists of gold and silver, and will always seek a way to trade it for the better things in life. On the other, a heavily armed, itinerant soldier is the very definition of a poor credit risk. The economist's barter scenario might be absurd when applied to transactions between neighbors in the same small rural community, but when dealing with a transaction between the resident of such a community and a passing mercenary, it suddenly begins to make a great deal of sense. For much of human history, then, an ingot of gold and silver, stamped or not, has served the same role as a contemporary drug dealer's suitcase full of unmarked bills, an object without a history, valuable because one knows it will be accepted in exchange for other goods just about anywhere, no questions asked. As a result, while credit systems tend to dominate in periods of relative social peace, or across networks of trust, whether created by states, or in most periods, transnational institutions like merchant guilds or communities of faith, in periods characterized by widespread war and plunder, they tend to be replaced by precious metal. What's more, while predatory lending goes on in every period of human history, the resulting debt crises appear to have the most damaging effects at times when money is most easily convertible into cash.
And that's where we're going to have to leave David Graeber this week due to time. Food for thought for any would-be gold bugs out there who think that returning to value of precious metals would somehow help the 99% break free from the domination of the 1% who pocketed a lot of the precious metals around anyway. I foresee a bigger change, one in which centralized claims of ownership, legality, and other such hierarchical privileged institutions are relaxed and people are more focused on living in harmony with nature and with those people around them. To discuss this episode, you can go to its webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/597. Like all previous episodes, this one is available for download from our archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music is by Woody Guthrie, with music by Billy Bragg and Wilco. Thank you for listening, and I hope the show has helped you adjust to a more local, less hierarchical, more consensus-based, and more friendly world.